Blog Talk Radio.
Here comes the big bad wolf.
Gonna blow your house down. It's another exciting edition of the Christo Radio Show here on Brilliant Ideas Radio. Got another exciting show for you. It's just week after week of just nonstop fun. Summer's here already. It happened out of the blue. I know it seemed like we had the longest winter of all times, but now we're smack dab in the middle of the blazing heat. It's just so hot and so humid here in the Northeast and New York, particularly for me because that's what I know about, but I know there's probably more areas out there that are feeling it just as much. But, you know, that's where we get all the fresh produce from. That's how we get all those tasty things to put on our tables, to cook in our kitchens. If we didn't have these warm summer months, and we've got some wonderful things in season right now. We've got arugula, beets. Told you last week about the beet greens. But now we've got apricots and blackberries and blueberries. And if you live in parts of the country, like, say, Hawaii or something, you've got pineapple. Tomatoes are starting to come around. Duck and lamb, for those of you that enjoy that sort of thing. All your little baby lambs that were born in March, well, it's time to put those babies on the table. I hope we don't lose any listeners over that little comment, but, you know, that's where our food comes from. It comes from farms, so we need to support those farmers out there. And grilling tips. I'd go through a whole list of things every week. I do what's fresh and tasty. I just did that there for you, told you what's going on. I give you a grilling tip. And my grilling tip for you today is just a common sense one. It's pretty simple. If you're using a charcoal grill, I use gas myself, but a lot of people like charcoal. They seem to enjoy that extra flavor that they get from those briquettes, or if they use hardwoods or things like that. But if you want less cleanup, because it is a little bit of a messy thing to be using your charcoal grill, just line the bottom of your kettle with some heavy-duty aluminum foil. It's going to radiate the heat up more, in fact. It's going to create more of a reflective surface, but it's going to give you a nice, easy thing to just bundle up and toss out when you're all done. And just do that each and every time. Just a nice, maybe a layer, maybe two, however many you think you need, so that it can support those coals and make cleanup easy. And isn't that a wonderful little grilling tip? Okay, so what's cooking in my kitchen? Tons of things. My son's on summer vacation right now. So he's 16, eats like a horse, got to feed him a lot. I found that I just make a lot of things in advance for him now. I'm not even worrying. I don't know if you watch on Facebook or on my blog that I'll do these little plates and little platters for him. And you know, it'll be called Gotta Feed the Kid. And you know, there'll be little ornate stuff. Right now, it's not. Right now, I'll just roast maybe two whole chickens, leave them in the fridge, let him deal with it. So there's a little tip for you people out there. If you've got children right now and hanging around the house and they're older, just make up a bunch of stuff and stock the fridge. When I was a kid, my mom made pizzas. She would make the dough and all that, and she would freeze these pizzas, half-bake them, freeze them. So we had, like, that, you know, that sort of whatever frozen brand of pizza that you get out there, but we had my mom's version. So that's another great thing to do is just have those. And kids can get them out, pop them in the oven, they warm up, they crisp up. There you go. Some major tips today. I'm trying to get ready here because we've got a heavy hitter in the wine world coming up as my guest. I'm really excited about this. I've partnered with these people. I've done some recipes for them. I've had their wine. It's fantastic. They're a little boutique winery, and they're in the mountain arts community of Idlewild, California. And we've got none other than the wine master himself, Mr. Chris Johnston. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Christo.
Hey there. Glad to have you on today. How's it going for you out there?
Oh, it's just beautiful. It's a gorgeous morning. You mentioned it was nice and getting hot out there. I double-checked the old thermometer here, and it's a whopping 65 outside and under clear skies.
Well, let's see. Now, that's just perfect. And you're in kind of a little mountain area. You were having some wildfires or some issues recently, but I think that's all taken care of.
Yeah. We had a pretty good one about a year ago. It set us back about 23,000 acres. It was a pretty impressive sight. But, yeah, no, we're doing fine this year.
That's good to hear. I mean, it's scary.
Yeah,
I grew up in New Mexico, and wildfires are just kind of a common thing. You want to blame somebody, but when it's a wildfire, there's no one to blame. It's just part of nature.
Right, rightio. You are absolutely right on that.
So tell us a little bit about Middle Ridge Winery. I've had some of these wines. Let's start just with that one question. What is a boutique winery? What would that mean to some of the listeners out there when they hear that word?
Well, boutique generally implies something that would be classified as very small lot production, very hands-on. There is a term being tossed around in the industry right now called garagiste. It's exactly as it sounds. It's basically a garage wine. Well, I don't make it in a garage, but it basically means that you're putting out 1,500 cases and fewer a year. So we ping-pong between 1,000 to 1,600 cases a year, depending upon what I'm putting together. And it's just all very hands-on, craft-made wine. It's much like you can find a craft brewery in any major metropolitan area or even out in the suburbs. We just happen to do wine.
That's so cool. Now, I saw recently you were talking about some new blends or a new thing you were working on, and you were asking people a question about there, and I think the answer was Meritage, or I forget what it was, but you have something that you're going on, you're doing right now.
Right. Exactly right. One of the blends that I put together, it's a Bordeaux-style blend, but being here in the United States, of course, we can't use the name Bordeaux because that's a French place name. So there is a contest held several years ago, I can't remember how long ago, decades ago, where they had to come up with a new name. They couldn't call it Bordeaux, so what do you call it? Well, the winner came up with a term. There was a combination of the word meritage and heritage. Pardon me, merit and heritage, and so that's how meritage came about. And so basically, it's a non-specific blend. You have five grape varietals that you can use in it. You know, everybody knows Cabernet Sauvignon, everybody knows Merlot, and you got Cabernet Franc, Petit Verdot, and Malbec. Those are the five primary blenders that you use. And none of them can be over 75%. So
you just heard me there pronounce it wrong. It's not Meritage. There's no need to Frenchify everything. It's Meritage.
Meritage.
You know, and I like how you used the term garagiste a little while ago.
Yeah.
I don't know why you can't call your wine Bordeauxiste or something.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, well, it's a pretty tightly regulated industry, I'll tell you. It keeps us going. Just even coming up with the name, you know, on our label for one of our product lines, we have something we call Cocktail Sourlie, where it's basically a beverage. I make it in the style of champagne. I do all the steps of champagne, where you ferment your base and you put it in the bottle with some sugar and yeast, and you let the yeast generate the gas in the bottle, and you disgorge it and you top it up with whatever. So I make something that's a direct take off of the Moscow Mule, and I have another one that we call Promiscuous, and you can find it on the website. It's an interesting blend of Barbera grape and pomegranate and bay leaves and hibiscus flowers and black peppercorn. But the logo on that, it was originally cocktails. Well, the federal government said, no, you can't use the word cocktail. So, my wife, being the clever marketing person she is, came up with this idea of using a rooster. Well, another name for a rooster in this world is cock, right? So you have
correct.
This the rooster, and then T-A-L-E-S, cocktails, sourlie. So we got around the feds. So
very tricky. Very tricky. Very creative.
Yeah, it works out. But yeah, so but the Meritage blend, back to that, you know, I love doing that style blend. It's the one that always takes me the best awards at competition.
You've won a few awards too.
Oh yeah.
Tell us about those. Tell us what that's like when you enter into something like that and how that happens. And
well, commercial wine competitions, you know, it's they're some are sponsored by state fairs, some are sponsored by not-for-profit organizations looking for fundraising, and the judges are all your peers in the industry. They're typically wine critics or other winemakers from very famous wineries, different winemakers from different regions, so that they can all taste, you know, and keep it more of a peer-based review. So you take your wine, you submit it, you know, they want either 4 or 6 bottles at a time, and you wait. And, you know, of course you send what you think is going to perform the best. And when you get that notification, either in the U.S. mail or email, and then shortly thereafter, the FedEx guy shows up, makes my dogs go bananas barking, and then you wind up with a little treasure trove of medallions. And
that's so cool. So you don't necessarily have to be there then.
No, you don't. No, you don't. Because these judgings can take 2 to 3 days. So can you imagine being a professional judge having to sit there and sample hundreds of wines a day?
Mm. No, I can't even imagine. I got invited to be a barbecue judge one time.
Yeah.
And that was a nightmare. Oh, my God. I couldn't eat barbecue for like a year after that. I would probably be off wine if I had to do a wine thing.
Yeah. Oh.
But, you know, there's a risk with that, because what if they keep the wine at the wrong temperature or they mishandle it? You know, there seems to be a lot of error that could occur in one of those, send your wine off to the state fair and let them judge it.
Yeah, and you just hope that somebody's got the right protocol down to store it appropriately and not completely mishandle it, and you hope to heck that your freight forwarder isn't going to go bouncing it up and down the highway for you. So, yeah, there's a lot of if, and, ors, or but. If you're going to enter a home wine competition or commercial competition, my advice to you is try to get that wine shipped up to them as early as possible. So, you know, as soon as you register for the competition, get it up there so it can just – it needs time to relax and get over that bottle shock of being, you know, transported.
Mm-hmm.
But you were absolutely correct. You know, there's a lot of abuse.
You know, let's talk about bottle shock for a second there. That's an interesting concept. Can that occur? Like, say, if I ride a bicycle around the city – and I'll go and pick up some wine from the wine store, and I'll come up. Would I be creating bottle shock at that point? Would it be just silly of me to open up the wine within an hour or so when I get home, or should I just let that sit for a few days and stockpile a little bit?
Well,
an interesting concept. I haven't thought about that.
Yeah, you're correct. I mean, how soon would I open that bottle up when I got home? Well, it all depends upon how thirsty I am.
Well, there you go.
But
phooey on bottle shock.
but really, you know, it's where's that desperation point, man?
Right. The only bottle shock we're going to experience is when I throw that empty bottle into the trash.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, if you had the ability to let it sit for a little while, I always like to let it sit. You know, it doesn't have to be a week or a month, but, you know, you give it a day to get over, you know, because if you can think about that little bit of headspace and whatever, you know, atmosphere is in there, you're shoving things all around in the wine again.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. You know, and even people that are throwing them in their car or you know, strolling along country roads, you know, swinging their little stack around, they may not realize that they're agitating sediments or agitating things in there that can alter the flavor of the wine. Most people may and may not notice those subtle differences. Someone like you, knowing that how it tastes in its optimum condition, you might notice those little subtle things, but most people may and may not pick that up.
Right. I mean, you know, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you to tell us a little bit about Blues Creek Vineyard.
Blues Creek. Blues Creek is one vineyard that I have consistently stayed with since 2008. 2008 was my first harvest from that vineyard. It was a newly planted vineyard at that time. And it's about 2.5 acres, all planted to, it's an Alsatian clone, so it's clone 55 of Pinot Grigio. So instead of the Italian version of the Pinot Gris, it's the French version. So the clusters are smaller, the berries are darker. I mean, you would swear it was a red wine grape just looking at it. Very, very, very aromatic. I mean, just loads of apples, loads of pear. Works pretty consistently in and out each and every year. I mean, the taste texture might come out differently a little bit just because of seasonal variances, but the aromatics are always right there. Blues Creek got its name from the owner's dog. In his backyard of his home, he's got a rather large water feature, and Blue was this big old, what was he, yellow lab? And he, in the summer months, he would sit there, walk out in the middle of this water feature, and just plop down. So it became Blues Creek.
That's a good name, too.
So, yeah, it's a cool story. We have a nice, on the website, we have a kind of a tribute to the Blues Creek. It's in our vineyard section of the website if people wanted to go see that.
No, and you have a new website out, just so everybody knows. It's www.middleridge.com. It's recently been updated. There's a blog on there. There's news. There's photos. There's a section that I just now popped onto, the Idlewild deer sightings.
Yes.
So since you are in an artist community, you support a lot of the local artists out there. And you've got this little series. Tell us about that a little bit. These are some cool-looking labels.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you for that compliment. Yeah. We are huge supporters of what's called the Art Alliance of Idlewild. And the town per capita, I don't know where I heard this statistic, but per capita, this town has the highest density of artists anywhere in the nation. We're a town of 3,300 people, but it seems like everybody here is an artist.
They work in mixed media, in photography.
Pick it. If it's an art, they
are
do
you there right there? Sounds like someone just came up and put you in a headlock.
Yeah, you know, it's like, holy smoke. So the...
Did you call 911?
Yeah, let me get another cup of that half-calf, decaf. But in any case, so this whole town is great, you know, and we came up with this thing. There was an installation part, you know, like I know in Chicago they had the cows on parade, and I know New York's had installation art projects before, but we had our first one, and it was 22 aluminum deer painted by local artists. And so we sent them out for juried review. And that's how we got the pictures, was the group of people decided that these six were going to be on the bottle of wine.
Well, you know what? So people don't think that this is just a mystical place like Utopia and Nirvana, because Idlewild sounds like that. You know, I'm going off to Idlewild, and when I'm on the way there, I'm going to stop at Utopia, and I'll visit Nirvana along the way. Tell everybody where Idlewild is. It is a real place. It's in California. Where exactly are you?
Okay. We are in the Southern California area, about an hour and a half north of San Diego, about the same east of Orange County or Los Angeles. We're on the western side of the big mountain, Mount San Jacinto, that's behind Palm Springs. So we're a town of about 3,300 people at 5,300-foot elevation. And there you have it. It's nice rarefied air up above the smog. We get to look at what everybody else is breathing.
And you know what? That's good for me to know, because for some reason, even though our communication relationship has gone on for probably a couple of years now, you and I,
yeah.
I always thought you were in Northern California.
Oh, yeah. Well, no,
I guess I never read the stuff.
That's too funny. Well, you know, Northern California is up over there. You know,
well, because I would see the mountains and I would see all those things you're posting, and that to me, in my mind, triggered a northern idea.
That's pretty cool.
Because mountains are in the north, right?
Right. I mean, we're more towards the desert side of the world. I mean.
No, that's completely. Come on, Palm Springs. You can't get more desert than that. You're out there in the Joshua Tree area.
Oh yeah, I mean, but at least, you know, we're not reaching $120 in temperature up here. You know, if it, you know, I mean, I think the hottest day I've ever endured up here is barely 90. So
that's crazy because, you know, I've been to Joshua and I've been to the Palm Springs. It's blazing there.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Summertime, yeah. Don't get out of the car.
Yeah, it's brutal. So let's see here what we've got. I'm cruising through the website a little bit. You've got your blog now, which everybody out there, I've got some recipes in there.
Yes, you do.
Yes, I do. I'm really excited about that. I post links to them here and then. I get a big kick out of being in this area. Look, there I am right there with my grill.
Yeah, that lovely mug.
So you've got Petit Verdot.
Yes.
That comes up a lot, that little phrase. Everyone's Petit Verdot is sort of trendy.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is it's a blender. Petit Verdot has typically been a blending stock that's not generally put out as a standalone. Because it's so tannic, it's so coarse. So, you know, this one, when I released that, it was 33 months in French oak just to get the tannins to tone down.
Wow.
Yeah, so if you can imagine letting a wine sit in a wood barrel for almost 3 years, just camping out, waiting for it to get to the right place, and then you could bottle
it. I bet that just adds such a luxuriousness to it.
Oh, it does. It lightens it right up. It makes it easy to very, very easy to drink compared to what it could be. I mean, if you ever taste Petit Verdot coming right out of the press, you know, when it's when you're finished with fermentation, or, you know, your first year right out of the barrel, you'd be taking a credit card to your tongue scraping those tannins off.
Oh my God, it's just almost chewy, right?
Yeah. You know, get a ribeye that's about 40% fat. You might be able to cut some of that through.
Wow. And these are little grapes or little berries, right?
They're
a lot different than the normal ones.
Right. Yeah. So it's a little bit smaller. It makes for a very good blending component.
So I used a couple of terms the other day when I was announcing that you were coming up, and I can say the second one, the viticulturist.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, oenologist.
Oenology.
Oenology. See, there you go. I look things up, and I don't even know how to say them.
Yeah, viticulturist is the guy that grows the grape. The oenologist is the one that converts it to wine.
And you are the oenologist.
I am the oenologist side of this world. I mean, otherwise I kill plants. So we
right. You're the you're the hunter in this whole in this whole scenario.
Feed me. So.
All the little grapes start crying and screaming, oh, no, here it comes.
Oh, no. And it's the birds going, oh, man. So.
Well, I've enjoyed your wines immensely, and I think everybody needs to just try them. You've got a wine club. There's a lot of ways to get them.
Yep.
They're not hard to get.
No.
Right now you've got 10% off right here on your website, so. Let people sign up and get a nice 10% off. Join the Mixed Wine Club.
Yeah.
See what's in that one. I guess you could just mix and match, right? Or you can
well,
choose
yeah,
what you want.
Right. We select those as the time goes on. So, you know, depending upon what we've got ready and what I think is going to be good for the wine club shipment, we try to mix them up, put them out in a box. So if it's mixed right now, you get a bottle of the Meritage, a bottle of the Cabernet Sauvignon with the photograph of the deer called Dottie, and a bottle of Pinot Grigio. If your friends from New York are planning on jumping on board, well, give me a little bit. I'm trying to get my licenses put back together.
Okay, so you hear that, people in New York? You got to wait.
Got to wait just a little bit. Yeah, our management company I was using had a little discovery about taxation and shipping into New York, so that kind of unscrewed a few things for me, so now I got to go file my own paperwork.
Well, I'm sure if there's anybody out there interested, like a true New Yorker, they'll find ways to circumnavigate the law.
Yeah, it's amazing how things happen, right?
They'll just magically have a Pennsylvania address or something. I don't know how that'll happen.
Yeah, go. Yeah.
Be able to do it.
Yeah.
So tell us about some of these cocktails that you make. You did a Moscow Mule. I know you sent me one of those, the Mule.
And I got that promiscuous. I got to send that over to you. The Cocktails Sur Lee program is interesting. I've got three of them. One of them is not listed here. But this was, in fact, if you go to the wines tab and you look at the Cocktails Sur Lee, you'll see the logo where you got the rooster and the tail Sur Lee.
Mm-hmm.
There's a gentleman by the name of Jeff Josenhans, who's the master mixologist slash sommelier from a five-star down in San Diego called the U.S. Grant Hotel. And this is an old building that's celebrated their 100-and-something birthday recently. And he comes up with creative cocktail ideas. Well, they were taking my wines, and then I brought some more samples for him to try, and he says, hey, I got something for you to try. And he was making these sparkling cocktails down in his kitchen, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know, you know, if you're fermenting these and you're planning on selling them, it's not quite legal. So I said, you know, however, I'll gladly help you. So, you know, I explained the only problem is I have to use fresh fruit, fresh vegetable, you know, fresh fruit or fresh grape, right? I couldn't use, forget vegetables. I can't really use grain. So we started tinkering around, and the Moscow Mule came out. The recipe's easy. It's 600 gallons of muscat grape juice, 300 pounds of hand-sliced ginger, and 10 pounds of hops.
There you go. See, people, write that down out there.
Yeah.
300 pounds.
600 gallons.
600 gallons.
Gallons.
300 pounds.
Yeah.
If you weren't listening.
Yeah, and 10 pounds of hops. So what happens is you ferment that out, you clean it up, and you get some more sugar and yeast and nutrient. You put it back in the bottle, and it takes up to about 65 psi of pressure. And then when I finally get done with it, I have a dosage liqueur that I put together, and you hit it with grape vodka at the end.
You know,
so,
I had the mule. It was so the ginger.
Yeah.
Was what really made it on that. It wasn't over gingerly. You have to try it to understand it. It's so delicate, but full.
Yeah.
You could have that at the same time. It's just rich in flavor, but each little nuance is so delicate. It's just right there. It's like the soft little bubbles, the softness of it all.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, it's amazing.
Oh, yeah. It's a direct takeoff of the Moscow Mule. So, you know, if you taste a Moscow Mule, you taste this, you go, hey, wait a minute. Except for mine's all made out of grape juice and fresh ginger.
So these are the bottle-conditioned cocktails. It's in the champagne method.
Right.
So everything's happening right there. All the fermentation, every single thing takes place right in the bottle.
That is it. That is it. And, you know,
so I've got one that's
promiscuous. It's
a made-up cocktail that Jeff came up with. It's since I had the privilege of editing the page on this one, I put in a real lady killer. Well, women really like that one. I've got a third flavor coming out. I'm still working on it because the final dose is a little bit of a problematic thing is, so all of this is experimentation until you get it into production. But I've got a Cosmopolitan takeoff. So it's a direct takeoff of the Cosmopolitan cocktail.
Nice, nice. Well, this promiscuous, a real lady killer, that's, you know, that falls right into there, that category of candy's dandy, but liquor's quicker, right?
Yeah. Well, and you do want to go easy on this stuff because I do take it up to about 3% residual sugar and somewhere between 15 and 16 alcohol.
Well, here we go. That was see how fast it goes?
Hey, this is a lot of fun.
I hear Robo Drum coming in already. That means we got to wind it up. I hope people learned some things about your Middle Ridge Winery. I hope they learned about bottle shock. I didn't think about that before. That's my takeaway from this one is bottle shock. People don't realize that they're probably destroying their wine by bouncing it around. Just take it home, let it rest a little bit. It's the same resting that you want to do when you open it. Let it rest. Treat it gently. Anyway, everybody, I hope we can get you some of these samples out there. I hope people can try this wine somehow. New Yorkers, you're going to have to wait. The rest of the world, log on. www.middleridge.com. And thanks again. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye, everybody.
When you thought radio was safe. A new kind of radio is on its way. Food, music, and friends. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. 365 days a year. Coming in 2014.